Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian, your weekly cruise through the most interesting news from the future. My name's Bobby Johnson, and once again I'm standing in for Alex Kwiatkowski to captain you on this voyage where we aim to pilot you through the stormy seas of technology and emerge on the calm, flat oceans of tomorrow. This week we're going to hear from a man who's leading the $125 million fight against Google Books, and we'll talk to somebody who thinks that online piracy is in fact the most important driver in modern culture. If that's not enough, we'll also be hearing why it's a bad thing when you get on the wrong side of a search engine. Now, with all that to fit in, as well as the news and your comments, I think we're going to need a bigger boat. So get your sea legs ready and strap on your sou'wester. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. A few years ago, Google started a project to scan in millions of books from libraries around the world, a scheme that was hailed at the time by many as a revolution and one that managed to rope in august partners such as Oxford's Bodleian Library and the New York Public Library. Not everybody was so keen, however. The Association of American Publishers and the Authors Guild launched a legal action against Google, claiming that it infringed their rights to build a search engine that gave readers access to books in this way. Well, last year, the internet giant thought it had come to a compromise with them by offering a settlement that would see Google pay $125 million for the rights to digitise those books, to sell access to them online, and to share the revenue with the publishers and the authors themselves. Sounds like everyone's happy, doesn't it? Except they're not. While the groups involved in the settlement signed up for a deal, not everybody thinks it's a good result. In fact, so many organisations are opposed to some of the terms that they've formed the Open Book Alliance, an umbrella group that's bringing together disparate organisations who wish to protest against it. That includes Microsoft, Amazon, Yahoo, librarians, writers and smaller publishers. Strange bedfellows indeed. Now, the men that are leading this effort are Peter Brantley, who works for the Internet Archive, and the well-known antitrust lawyer Gary Reback, who is famous for his role in cases like Netscape v Microsoft. So what exactly is their problem with the settlement, and how does it feel to be at the forefront of a battle against the internet's most powerful company? I caught up with Peter earlier this week to find out.
The settlement creates essentially a court-sanctioned monopoly of access for Google to commercialize 20th century literature. The books that the settlement contains are either U.S. works that are registered with the Copyright Office or international works that might have a U.S. interest. So essentially any international work that was held by a library and digitized falls into the terms of the settlement. So it's quite a wide swath of literature, and because it is a class action in the United States, all members of the class are swept into the agreement, and because of the language, all authors and all publishers are included in this. And so what that means is that even for works where authors or publishers do not come forward proactively to claim the work, those works, unidentified works, unclaimed works, or what are called sometimes orphan works, all of those works are still encompassed in the settlement. And Google is able to sell those books and sell access to those books through subscription, whereas no one else would be able to do that because no one else would be able to have the buy-in of the author or the publisher responsible for that work because they were unknown.
I suppose the particularly worrying thing is not only that, but a precedent for future agreements or cases that takes power out of the hands of authors and gives it to somebody else entirely.
I think there's a worry that this kind of privatized agreement for access to works where the rights holders are not known, or orphan works, might be extended to other kinds of media. So not just books, but maybe this kind of agreement winds up being cut for photographs or illustrations or film and movies. And that seems like an abrogation of how our legal system should work in these cases. I think there are also international concerns, because once you have an agreement like this that covers the U.S. territory, what are the ramifications for the international audience? You know, will the if this settlement was approved, would there be any compulsion to comprise a collection of UK books or French books? And, you know, how would that, you know, wind up serving a market when the U.S. market has been, sewn up in this monopoly? So I think that there are many ramifications for this kind of deal that are very disturbing to us.
Which brings us neatly to the Open Book Alliance, which is a loose grouping of organizations which you're part of, who are advancing different options or protesting the terms of the settlement. Can you talk us through who's in the alliance and how it came to be?
I was at the archive and beginning to cast about for other organizations that I suspected might have similar concerns. And I started calling around, and indeed, you know, I ran into many organizations who either privately or publicly enunciated concerns very similar to the ones that the archive had, the threats to innovation, the anti-competitive aspects of the settlement, the issues of privacy and tracking readers and the books that they're looking at. There's been a lot of attention paid to the fact that Amazon, which is not officially a member of this alliance as of the date that we're speaking, Microsoft and Yahoo have confirmed their participation. You know, and these three organizations have been named, but you know, really the Internet Archive and Gary Reback and some library associations were the early leaders of this, and we see this as really an organization that's quite heterogeneous in its composition. And there are writers groups now, there are library associations, there will be some publishing associations in this group. You know, we're very pleased to have this opportunity to speak with one voice.
There's an interesting, I think, an element in which everybody who is part of the alliance, or at least sympathizes and maybe become part of the alliance in the future, nearly all of them have a different reason. The essential thing you seem to agree on is that this settlement is wrong. Microsoft thinks it's wrong because it doesn't want Google to get this, you know, and some might speculate that if the shoe was on the other foot, Microsoft wouldn't be part of this alliance. Amazon clearly has interest in the book industry in a very specific way. You are lobbying for better open access and innovation. Other publishers groups and authors might just say, hang on a minute, the real problem with this is that we sold out too cheaply and we'd rather get a better, more financially pleasing settlement. How do you bring those threads together and stop a common goal becoming a problem because of the different reasons for objecting to it?
Well, you know, there's nothing neat about the problem of securing access to the broadest number of digital books under the widest possible number of mechanisms. And so, you know, you're absolutely right in observing that everyone comes to the table with, you know, a slightly different set of preferred outcomes or possibly even interests. And I think you've, you know, fairly well summarized some of the diversity of opinions. So it's true, we all agree, I think, on, you know, some of the core problems, and we can discourse amongst ourselves quite energetically what those are. But at the same time, you know, trying to find a path forward is the challenge that we face now. And I think to Google's credit and to succeeding efforts and certainly efforts such as the Internet Archives, the Open Content Alliance, where we've been digitizing books, we all have different interests, but we've learned a lot about how to make books available through these efforts. And, you know, I think we're looking at the legislative history that's gone before the U.S. Congress, and we're looking at the lessons of the music industry. We're looking at ASCAP and BMI.
There's a lot of legal jargon here, and there's a lot of arguments about very specific things. People mention orphan works. Not very many people actually know what an orphan work is. Can you give us examples of actual orphan works?
There's a distinction between works whose rights holders, authors and publishers, don't come forward, and books where we might never really be able to find out who the rights holder is. And the latter category is more akin to what we call orphan works. The orphan book problem is subject to a little bit of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So, you know, for many of these works, if you are willing to spend hours and hours digging through file cabinets, you may ultimately find a little bit of information about the book. I'll give you one, I think, good example. It's a personal one. My father acquired a PhD in English and wrote a book on the novelist John Dos Passos. And the book was published, his dissertation was published by an Italian publisher, I believe in the early 60s. The publisher, as far as I know, is now out of business. My father does not have a copy of the contract that he signed with the publisher. And it's not clear to him whether or not any copyright was renewed, and he wouldn't know where to check, you know, in the copyright office's holdings. So this is a book that certainly at least first glance might well be described as orphan. So these are quite, you know, typical circumstances. You know, what proportion of, you know, this sum of books of the 20th century orphans are is really hard to determine. And, you know, figures have ranged between 20 to 50 to even higher percentages of the number of books that have been digitized by Google. I think we just really don't know. It will be a large number. Even if it was one book, you know, we would still have to raise issues with how the settlement has been constructed and governed, but it will be in the millions.
Earlier in the conversation, when you said Google essentially started out with this kind of snippet approach that's very similar to the way they would do web search. Now they've gone from that to almost the other end of the spectrum entirely. Do you think they meant to do it?
Well, I certainly can't speak for Google. I think, you know, they're a company with a lot of very bright people. And I think, you know, when they looked at books, they really were looking at books for the first time like a web company. And as you said, I think they were looking at, you know, how do we make this content available to people? And I think it's that guiding principle of opening up the discovery to information that motivated Google. So, I think that where they are now is a very different place from where they started, and it may not have been a place that they anticipated when they initiated this conversation with publishers, with libraries, and ultimately with authors.
That was Peter Brantley of the Internet Archive and the Open Book Alliance. And if you want to find out more about the Google Books settlement, you can go to guardian.co.uk/techweekly, where we've got plenty of links for you. Now, let's change the pace a little bit by hearing this week's news headlines.
Nokia made its entry into the computer business this week, unveiling a new netbook computer that it says could be the next step in the evolution of its business. The booklet, which boasts a 10.1-inch screen and Atom processor, has built-in 3G networking and runs Windows, but it remains unclear whether the public will turn to Nokia in the already crowded and not very profitable PC market. An American blogger has said she'll sue Google after a Manhattan court ordered the internet giant to reveal her identity. Rosemary Port, a 29-year-old student, used her anonymous blog called Skanks in NYC to call model Siskula Cohen a psychotic, lying, whoring skank, among other things. Port now says she plans to file a $15 million suit against Google for complying with the order to unmask her. Apple's latest operating system, Snow Leopard, goes on sale this week ahead of speculation that the company is working on a new tablet computer for release next year. The iPhone maker is hoping it can get the jump on Windows 7, due to go on sale in October, with a system that promises to be faster and leaner than its predecessors and offers support for Microsoft Exchange. And finally, astronomers, scientists, and space watchers were celebrating this week as they marked the anniversary of Galileo's first telescope, which was originally unveiled 400 years ago. On August the 25th, 1609, the Italian astronomer showed off the telescope for the very first time, an eight-powered contraption that revealed previously unknown truths about the moon, the planets, and space itself.
Thanks very much for that tidal wave of news. And for more details on these stories and all the up-to-date headlines, you can go to guardian.co.uk/technology.
on this week's Science Weekly podcast. We're checking out some exquisite bodies. Actually, they're a bit gruesome. We're looking at how freak shows and sexy Victorian wax cadavers have helped medical science.
We've had some visitors peeking behind the curtain who looked like they wish they hadn't afterwards.
Plus, we look at real-life autonomous machines. For example, how do you overtake a truck that can think for itself?
Probably, probabilistically, far safer than the existing system.
That's all on Science Weekly from The Guardian.
Now, piracy remains one of the hottest topics around, particularly with the news that the British government is once again stepping up attempts to crack down on illegal file sharers. New proposals suggest that Business Secretary Lord Mandelson will assume responsibility for taking action against those accused of unauthorised file sharing. He could even gain the ability to force internet service providers to cut off access for repeat offenders. Now, with all that going on in the background, enter Matt Mason, a former pirate radio DJ turned author who believes that piracy is actually one of the biggest movements in modern culture. In his 2008 book, The Pirate's Dilemma, he argues that youth culture is the driving force behind innovation and that piracy and remixing is fast becoming just another business model. Kevin Anderson caught up with Matt a few weeks ago to find out more.
On one hand, I think as individuals, we really sort of see the opportunities in what's happening with digital content, and we all you know, relish that we can use all these new tools and share all this information. But at the organisational level, kind of collectives of people like governments and corporations just are not, don't seem to be there yet. When you actually look at it, people pay lip service or they have a Twitter feed on their corporate blog or whatever it is, but when you actually look at the serious stuff, the work being done, the lobbying, the legislation and things like that, all this stuff about sharing things is clearly still a threat to most big organizations, and it's something they're trying to stop happening.
So you've got, you know, the music and the movie industry worried, you know, initially it was Napster, and then any successive number of file sharing sites, now it's BitTorrent and Pirate Bay. Newspapers are saying Google's taking our content, so Google's the pirate in this instance. I mean, what's your suggestion for industries that are seeing their businesses disrupted by either technology or a mix of technology and piracy?
When something disrupts a system, the money doesn't disappear, it just moves. It goes somewhere else. And yeah, if at the moment Google are getting the money from what you're doing, then maybe you need to talk to Google, or maybe you need to be doing something else yourself. Maybe you need to be shifting your operations in a different way. So there's always an opportunity. It's not a case of, well, there's just no more money here ever, especially with newspapers. I mean, people are always going to need news. I think the interesting thing with the newspaper model is, if actual paper newspapers went away, news wouldn't go away. We'd still be able to get news. This is going on the this is a podcast, right? I mean, from The Guardian. So The Guardian is moving, and like everybody's moving, but it's just the money hasn't kind of caught up yet. You know, the money is still in the big handbag ad in the front section or whatever it may be. So that's the stuff we have to figure out. Unfortunately, with disruptive technology, that's the stuff that takes a little bit longer. You know, things, it's easy to break things, and it's harder to kind of mend them or find alternatives.
So after a lull of a few years where we didn't see a really high-profile piracy case, you know, we had actually had the war on Napster for a while and Grokster, and that all kind of came along. And then it was, you know, an uneasy quiet, if you will. Then we had Pirate Bay. What does the Pirate Bay trial and result mean?
For me, I think everybody lost that trial. Everybody lost. I was really surprised that the Pirate Bay lost, actually. I didn't see it coming. I don't think many people did, because the case was paper thin. First of all, there was the evidence against them was really thin on the ground, and it wasn't well put together, and the allegations that came out afterwards about the judge kind of made that make more sense. But the people that keep losing here, as long as this is the strategy, are content creators, are people who are in the business of making content and need new mechanisms to be paid for digital content. That's the problem. It's not about the reason that pirates exist. The reason that pirates always exist is because they represent some kind of failure. If you go back to like swashbuckling pirates, I mean, that was really about a different method for people to work on ships, because it was so oppressive in the Merchant Navy and the British Navy. You look at what's happening in Somalia, it's really a result of the state failing, of a failed government, the failure of Somalia as a country to kind of organize itself. And with digital piracy, it's always about market failure. It's always about the market is not doing something. So piracy happens. It's a symptom. It's not the problem. The problem is that we haven't done enough. We haven't been working hard enough to find these new business models.
Now, when I talk to people in the creative industry, and you know, some artists, but especially a lot of people who work for movie companies or music companies, they talk about it being a moral failing, that people suddenly think that stealing things are fine, and that normal people who wouldn't go into a shop and nick a candy bar will go in there, you know, and download a piece, you know, free music or download free movies. I mean, do you think this is a moral issue, or is you know?
There's definitely a moral component to it. I mean, the thing that I think people miss when they say that is that there are two ways that you stop people from doing things. One is with laws and legislation and rules, and the other way, which is often more powerful, is with social norms. It's what people think is acceptable and what isn't acceptable to do. There's loads of things you could do that aren't illegal that you wouldn't do because they're not acceptable. You know, there's loads of things that you do that you don't have to, that you do, you hold doors open or whatever. And the thing is with digital piracy is it's become the social norm. It's okay, like, for the generation that's grown up in the last 10 years, it's just normal. It's just something, it's just that's how you get music. And the reason for that isn't because they grew up with some moral deficiency that generations previously didn't have. It's because that's the world that we gave them to grow up in. There were no legal alternatives. iTunes was not a good enough legal alternative. And the models that are starting to take shape are, you know, frequently cut off at the knees, and majors won't work with them, and people still aren't collaborating on this problem in the way that they need to really deal with it.
Now, one of the issues when you move from sort of scarcity, which is what we've had, you know, you had a finite number of television stations, now you've got tons in digital. You had a finite number of movie houses, and now you've got lots more studios because it's easier to make things digitally than it was with film. Whenever you move from that sort of scarcity to abundance, and digital is part of that,
right,
suddenly the pricing changes quite a lot. So companies that are used to making millions of dollars are now having to subsist on a lot less. What happens with that?
Our entire economic model is changing. You know, the idea of we're moving to an economics of abundance is, maybe we need to be looking at economists who are working on this stuff, and there are too few of them. There are not enough people who take the economics of abundance seriously in the economic world at kind of that level. There's not enough new stuff coming out there. There are a lot of good business books and got people, very smart people, talking about this, but academically it's still like not really a big issue. But it is, it's the issue of our time, and all these problems we're seeing is just a shift is happening, but it's the pace is going to be glacial for a while, because we just kind of don't know what's going on. And it starts with new academic models and those things sort of trickling down and generally becoming accepted business practices, and that's part of it. We also need to see more people taking risks. So you can kind of measure, you can see things move quickly when somebody prominent does something. When Radiohead put out In Rainbows, there was a shift in people's thinking everywhere, not just in the music industry, actually more probably outside of the music industry, you know, in other industries. People noticed that. We need more things like that to happen. When they simultaneously release a Harry Potter movie in theatres and on DVD and online at the same time, that will change people's thinking. We need to see big companies taking risks, and slowly but surely, more of them will, because they don't really have another choice.
That was Kevin Anderson talking to Matt Mason, author of The Pirate's Dilemma. And if you want to indulge your love of eye patches and peg legs, you can visit his website, which is thepiratesdilemma.com. Now, Google's book settlement was complicated enough, but the claim that Mountain View is eyeing up a monopoly on digital books isn't the only complaint that the internet giant is fielding at the moment. Last week, The Guardian reported on the case of another company, British price comparison website Foundam, which has seen a 3-year struggle to get itself recognised by the world's largest search engine. With the typical website getting around 40% of its traffic from search, being banned from the listings can have a huge impact on how much traffic you get. And Foundam appears to be a prime example of how Google's secret search algorithm can affect someone's livelihood and even make or break a company. To explain exactly what happened, The Guardian's communications editor, Richard Ray, spoke to John Dennis.
3 years ago, June 2006, they suddenly realised that their traffic seemed to have dropped down dramatically. The service was still running, everything was still working fine, but obviously people weren't coming to see them. With a little bit of tweaking around on their own network, they realised that what had happened is their traffic from Google seemed to have disappeared. They assumed it was some sort of dreadful glitch and then got in touch with Google. A couple of weeks later, their own quality score on Google's platform, which allows them to put adverts next to the search terms, also suddenly got very bad, and they suddenly thought, okay, well, there's something going on here with AdWords as well. That happened 3 years ago, and the problem they had with the advertising was sorted out a year later. The problem with appearing in search results is still going on.
And what has it told us, this case, about the way Google works?
There's been a couple of very interesting connections between parts of the business that people know about and parts of the business that the industry, as in the online industry, understands, but most people don't really know about. The most obvious one is that search, which is what you and I would consider Google to be great at, has a connection with the advertising business. So say you're looking for an iPod or you're looking for a particular website and you put it into the Google search bar, you get all those hyperlinks in blue turn up. And at the top and down the side, you get a series of adverts. Occasionally you might click on them, most of the time, to be honest, you probably don't. Those blue links that you get ranked on that main page are produced by the search engine bit of Google. The bits at the top and the bits down the side are produced by this business called AdWords, which sells particular keywords that you would look for to potential advertisers. What is odd about this long-running investigation into Google is that the adverts that turn up in the natural search and the advertisers behind them and the companies behind them has relevance for which adverts are best served on that bit down the side.
The way that Google's search engine works is constantly evolving, isn't it?
Most consumers would assume that Google was set up by Larry Page and Sergey Brin, and that they just set it up, set it running, and from there on the rest is history. In actual fact, they run about 450 tweaks a year of their algorithm, so it's constantly evolving. Now, a lot of people in the internet world understand this and know this is what's happening, but for most consumers, they assume that what the internet they saw 2 years ago is being built on now, actually it changes every single, every single day for the way that you see things on Google.
And because Google's so massive, a tiny tweak could have a huge effect, and a devastating effect, I suppose, in some cases.
This is the ultimate worry about Google, especially in the UK, where we, because of the English language, and obviously we're so connected with America, and some of the other internet search engines never got that much traction here. They have 90% of the search engine traffic in the UK. If you are not on Google, you don't exist on the internet for someone who doesn't already know you. If you've got millions to spend on an advertising budget, you're fine. But if not, you rely on Google. There's a statistic from Hitwise, which is one of the people who tracks things on the internet, which is that 2 out of every 5 visits to a website in the UK come through Google. So if you're not on Google, you're really stuffed.
Google, as one of its stated aims, is not to be evil. There's no suggestion in this case that it has been evil, but I mean, should it be actually trying to do good?
It's the law of unintended consequences, that once you get to the sheer scale that Google has, with such a 90% of the UK search engine market, once you get to that kind of scale, any small tweak that you make to your algorithm and the way that you work can have massive unintended consequences. So some people within the business who've spoken to me have said, perhaps we should move from that old adage, which was don't be evil, to being positively good.
And what happened to Foundam?
They're still trying to get onto the search engine rankings. There are ways that you can do this. You can launch an advertising campaign. You can use search engine optimization. All these sort of technical terms, but they are still plugging away.
That was Rick Ray speaking to John Dennis there. You can find out more about Foundom and the power of search engines at guardian.co.uk/technology/Google. Right, that's enough for me. Now we've made it through our whistle-stop cruise of the week's technology stories, I'm off for a few cocktails on the poop deck. I just wanted to say, though, thanks to the people who left us feedback this week, including Cy Mini, who said that the show was masterfully done. In fact, he said, I would even say that not only do I find the podcast not boring, but may go so far as actually quite good. Well, thanks for that. Praise indeed. I also wanted to mention the fate of the Nethernet, the online game we heard about last week from guest Justin Hall. As commenter LoopyGirl8 pointed out, the company actually decided to close down the Nethernet the day before our show went out, leading, no doubt, to a little confusion. So, we're sorry to send you on a wild goose chase, but since we record the show a day or so before you get to hear it, these things do unfortunately happen from time to time. Anyway, it was good while it lasted, and I've spoken to Justin, and he says that his team are now building something new, and that we'll be the first to know when it goes live. So, that's good, I suppose. Of course, if you've got something to tell us about this week's show, or any of the stories on the site, then you can always leave a comment on the blog, message us through Facebook, or through Twitter. The details are all at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. All that remains for me is to thank our guests Peter Brantley and Matt Mason, to give a nod to the capable hands of Kevin Anderson, John Dennis and Richard Ray. This week's show has been the work of our tireless producer Scott Corley. My name is Bobby Johnson, and thank you for listening. See you next Tuesday.